Good afternoon. Welcome once again to Line One, your health connection on KSKA Anchorage. I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard, and my guest today is Dr. Peter Osterbauer. Dr. Osterbauer works with the Alaska Neurology Center and the Alaska Sleep Disorder Center, which are both kind of the same organization doing slightly different things. We'll be trying to understand sleep and sleep disorders, as well as certainly willing to address your questions about sleep during this next hour. You can reach us by calling 550-8433. That's 550-8433. We have an email address, line1@alaskapublic.org. You have to spell that out, L-I-N-E-O-N-E, line1@alaskapublic.org. And we also have a toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. Dr. Osterbauer went to medical school at the University of Tennessee. There are medical units in Memphis, Tennessee. Then he went on to Wilford Hall with the Air Force, where he did an internship and then residency in neurological sciences, where he also became a chief resident before eventually being transferred to Alaska at Elmendorf, where, among other things he did, he was also the medical director of the Traumatic Brain Injury Center there. Over the last year, he's left the military and now works for the Alaska Sleep Disorder Center, as we said earlier, and the Alaska Neurology Center. Dr. Osterbauer, it's a pleasure to have you here.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, let's get right to it. You, in some notes we exchanged before we came on the program, you'd mentioned that there's three components to a healthy life, and one of them is not alcohol, but it's physical fitness, eating right, and sleep.
That's right, and sleep is arguably one of the most important of the three, believe it or not.
So what is sleep?
Well, it's depending on who you ask, the way I see it is it's basically a way for our brain and our body to recharge itself, especially the brain. That's the time where it can rest, regenerate, and also memories can consolidate.
So what do you, there's been some real interest in this memory consolidation phase, and it leads to some misconceptions at times about what you can do while you're during sleep. But what do you mean exactly by memory consolidation?
Yeah, I've seen some interesting things.
People trying to sell you something. Usually.
Exactly. Yeah, right. Exactly. Yeah. Normally, and it sort of depends on who you ask or what websites you look at or whatever, but REM sleep, you know, we'll talk probably about some of the different stages of sleep, but REM is one of the stages of sleep, and it's generally where seen as one of the stages where we dream, and that's one of the times that memories can really consolidate. A lot of times you'll have dreams. I've had what I refer to as study dreams, where I'd be studying for a huge test or whatever, and then in my sleep, I'd be dreaming about the test. And that was a time where the brain can take the memories and file them in places where it can find them again. And, you know, you hear things about different memory techniques of playing things while you're asleep. And there may be some mild benefit to that, but... Mm-hmm.
And also, it seems to me that, and maybe I'm wrong, but you have a short-term memory and long-term memory working. There's more than one kind of memory when we
right.
talk about it. And so the consolidation is really kind to laying this down in a way that somehow we haven't quite figured out, I don't think, is how the mind will go about retrieving that information when certain associations are made.
Right, yeah. And a lot of that can be done during sleep because your brain's not busy mm-hmm. working on other things.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Is it done better or more commonly during sleep or not, or we don't know the answer to that?
Don't know the answer to that, okay. To be honest.
Okay. All right. So you said there's different phases of sleep. How do we know there are different phases? What instrument, what kind of technology leads us to that, and then what are we talking about?
Right. So the way we measure it during a sleep study is we have wires attached to the head, which we can see some of the brain waves. And the brain... It's like a supercomputer, basically. Sets off electrical impulses that we can see. Most people are familiar with an EKG that looks at the heart, where you can see the heart rhythm. And it's similar to that, only we're looking at the brain rhythms. And the electricity in the brain synchronizes. The two sides of the brain will synchronize with each other, and you'll see these, in a normal brain anyway, you'll see rhythmic patterns depending on what stage of sleep or wakefulness you're in. the deeper sleep that we are, the slower the brain waves go.
And so you're recording this when people are in sleep or when you're doing sleep studies, and you can tell when they're in various phases of sleep. And
yes.
Are there different things that happen during different periods of sleep?
Yeah, and again, it depends on who you ask. But while we're awake, we are generally in the what's called the beta stage, where it's so real fast activity. And then as we're drifting off to sleep, we go into alpha, which is a little bit slower. And that's the stage that we see when people are meditating. Mm-hmm. And then as we drift, that's the alpha is the stage where you're sort of half awake, half asleep. You might still be able to hear the cat behind you or whatever. Mm-hmm. And then as you go off further, you go into theta, which is even slower. And it's a transition between the meditative state and the deeper state, which is delta. Delta is where the brain really refreshes itself. So when you're in this stage two sleep, you're not awake, but you're not getting the full deep sleep that'll recharge your brain. So what I see a lot of times with people who just don't feel rested when they wake up or don't feel rested during the day, and I'll look at their sleep study, I'll see that they have plenty of stage one and stage two sleep, but no stage three, which is where all the rest, mm-hmm. or most of the rest comes.
Mm-hmm. I'm going to guess. So like the other night I was on call, I got a call at 2:30, I'm awake, I have trouble going back to sleep, I'm reading, and finally I start to drift back off. But I never felt like I was really, I don't think it was as deep sleep. So I'm assuming that's kind of not as restful of a sleep as it was. I knew I was going to have to get up eventually.
Yeah.
So that's the kind of thing people might notice.
Yes. Uh-huh. Yeah. Yeah. And sort of this, when you said that, it triggered a thought when we take naps during the day.
Right.
And you know, we've all taken naps that we wake up feeling refreshed and great afterwards, and then we have naps that we wake up feeling worse than we did before. Mm-hmm. And the thought is that when we wake up feeling bad, it's because we were in a deep stage of sleep, and you know, it takes a lot to get your brain from that slow wave pattern back up into the wakefulness state. Mm-hmm. So you end up waking up feeling foggy and disoriented and mm-hmm. and not good. So if we're going to plan naps, we want to try to plan them to where we don't, you know, if you can plan your nap, do it for either less than 20 minutes so that you don't get into the deeper stages of sleep. Or if you've got a while, plan for at least an hour and a half, which is roughly a full sleep cycle.
And you mentioned REM sleep, and I guess there's a non-REM sleep. What does REM stand for, and what are we talking about there?
So REM is rapid eye movement, and again, that's the stage where we do most of our dreaming. And they call it REM because if you watch someone while they're asleep, when they go into REM sleep, their eyes will be closed. But if you look, you can see their eyeballs moving back and forth behind their eyes. And we're not really exactly sure why that happens, why we move our eyes back and forth. Don't know if it's that, you know, there's some movie screen behind our eyes that we're watching as we dream or what it is, but mm-hmm. that's what we see when people are dreaming. And during that time also the body paralyzes itself, or it's supposed to. There's some disorders mm-hmm. where it doesn't, but it does that so that as we're dreaming we don't beat ourselves up or beat up our bed partner if we're having mm-hmm. a bad dream or chasing somebody or whatever.
Mm-hmm. Can you, if you're watching somebody in a sleep study or somebody happens to be watching somebody else sleep, can you tell when they're in REM sleep by watching the movement of their eyes, or is that overdone?
It's a clue. Mm-hmm. You really have to put the whole picture together. Okay. Because you can still move your eyes in other stages.
Okay. I'm going to remind listeners again, this is Line 1, your health connection, and our discussion today centers around sleep. So if you've got questions about sleep or sleep disorders that you'd like to have answered, why don't you give us a call? Our local number is 550-8433. That's 550-8433. You can also reach us during the next 45 minutes or so at line1@alaskapublic.org if you want to send a brief, short, succinct email that I can take a look at real quickly, and we can see if we can get your questions answered. Nowadays, we hear a lot also about something called functional MRI. What, if you don't mind telling me what a functional MRI is, and are we learning anything about sleep from functional MRIs?
Yeah, so a functional MRI, a lot of people are familiar with an MRI, magnetic resonance imaging, and it's a giant magnet that basically lets us be able to see inside of parts of our body. And so with a functional MRI, they're, of course, looking at the brain, and they can provide the brain with different stimuli that can light up different parts of the brain. Mm-hmm. A lot of it's still in the experimental stages. Right. And they're looking into sleep some with that. The problem with sleep functional MRI is that anyone that's had an MRI knows that it sounds like people beating trash cans around your head. So it can be hard to sleep in there. The noise itself can throw the brain waves off a little bit. But you can tell when someone's in REM. And the specifics aren't clear, but I know that they're also looking with autistic children. They're seeing some different sleep patterns with the functional MRI.
Mm-hmm. And I might be quick to point out, and I want you to correct me when you say things like that, is that people may interpret that as a useful test for diagnosing autism, because that is an issue is how to go about it. That is an experimental thing that's being looked at, and there may be similar findings in other diseases and so forth. We really have to work that kind of information
Before
it goes to real time.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay. And so the function of sleep, as you mentioned, is kind of a recharging kind of issue, metabolically, is that
yes.
what you're talking about?
Yeah, metabolically electronically.
Uh-huh.
It's good to reboot your computer every once in a while.
Right.
It does that for the brain, but metabolically, without getting too entangled in all the details, you know, the brain works on glucose, and there's a storage form of glucose called glycogen. And during sleep is where a lot of the glycogen has a chance to replenish itself. You know, during the day when we're out looking around and doing things and having to think, the brain's constantly burning up its supplies, so it doesn't really have a chance to regenerate itself. And that's why if someone's sleep deprived over time, they really deplete their glycogen reserves. So, you know, they end up feeling really, really foggy and cognitive difficulty, just slow thinking, trouble thinking of the right words. The brain, it's all there in your brain. It doesn't have the energy to get it out as fast as it should.
And there have been studies that I've read about where there's prolonged sleep deprivation for several days. And I'm guessing if this is an important function for the brain to recharge, that we can get some very significant consequences with very prolonged sleep deprivation.
Yes. Yeah, you can see hallucinations. You can see psychotic behavior.
Right.
It can be a pretty scary thing.
All right. So sleep is important.
Yes.
We, as many things, we don't understand it completely.
Mm-hmm.
Not having enough sleep is not good.
Right.
And up here, it may be a particular problem.
Yes. Yes.
At certain times of the year.
Yes. And it really depends on what type of person you are. Sometimes it's worse in the summer. Sometimes it's worse in the winter. It's, too much sleep sometimes can be just as bad as not enough.
Do we have much data on the fact that that maybe as a society we're having less sleep or more sleep disorders or more sleep deprivation than we used to have?
Yeah, and I don't have good numbers for you, but definitely as a society, you know, we're in this go type of mentality, so we're definitely getting less sleep. And there are more sleep disorders being diagnosed, and I don't know, it's probably partially because we're not sleeping as much, but it's probably partially because we know where to look now, too. You know, in the past, a lot of it may have gone undiagnosed just because we didn't know where to look.
Right. I was looking at a map from the CDC, and when you look at the Alaska map, the higher amounts of what people report as their own as having sleep deprivation or sleep problems, it seems to be centered perhaps more around urban areas. I don't know that necessarily follows in the lower 48, but it leads to the question is, we might expect there to be more sleep problems, sleep deprivation in urban centers. Have you ever heard that's true or is not necessary?
Yeah, I've heard mixed mixed results on that. I haven't really made up my mind.
Okay. All right. Well, let's start talking a little bit more about sleep in particular, and perhaps you can give us some hints about sleep hygiene, how we can do a better job of getting to sleep when we need to.
Yeah. So sleep hygiene is probably one of the most important things that I try to help my patients with, at least. And what that means is that there's something to be said for having a nighttime routine. You know, some people will read a book or take a bath, or if you can have a wind down routine, it helps your brain get ready for sleep. And it also sort of, I mean, for lack of a better word, this word has bad associations attached to it, but it sort of programs your brain to be ready for sleep if you can do it regularly. And when I say regularly, it's important, if at all possible, to go to bed at roughly the same time every night and to wake up at roughly the same time every day, even on weekends or days off. And that's not always easy, because I'm like just about everyone else. I like to sleep in on my days off, you know. But it's, if you're really wanting to optimize your sleep, that's not good practice. It's good to figure out a time that's reasonable for you to go to bed roughly the same time every night and wake up roughly the same time every morning. Mm-hmm. A couple of other things, you know, in Alaska, of course, in the summertime, we have the light. And after about roughly 6 o'clock-ish or so, you want to try to avoid any really bright lights. And this goes in the wintertime, too, because in the wintertime we have the house lights on, and you don't want to be shining bright lights in your eyes. You want to have sort of a dimmer room that you can be in at least a couple hours before you go to bed. And again, this lets your brain know that it's time to start winding down, but light also triggers the brain to try to be awake, because it thinks it's supposed to, basically. So dim lights, if you can, you want to avoid watching action movies or real intense movies or listening to intense music just before you go to bed, because again, that activates the brain. Same thing with exercise. Exercise is good for us and it's important, but you don't want to do it probably about 2 to 3 hours before you go to bed. You want to avoid exercise because again, it ramps up your system and would make it hard to sleep.
I get questions in my age group as a pediatrician about video games towards nighttime, particularly in adolescent boys.
Yes. Yep.
Yeah. What do you think about that?
Yeah, it's hard to calm your brain down when you've been shooting up the galaxy for a couple hours.
Trying to save your life. What about other things? We haven't talked about medications or maybe even foods that we eat and how they might affect sleep.
Right. Yeah. And there are several medications that can... there's a few antidepressants that are more activating antidepressants that you want to take them in the morning versus in the evening. I do see that quite a bit when patients will come in. I'll take a look at their medication list and I'll say, you know, you really should be taking this one in the morning. Thyroid medication is one that can be energizing. And as far as medications to help with sleep, I try to avoid that if at all possible. It's very easy to become dependent on them. There are a few that are non-habit forming, quote unquote, but even with those, you can get to where you depend on them too much. So it's always best to, if you can, to not become dependent on medication.
Is there much evidence that a little bit of alcohol before you go to sleep helps you go to sleep?
You know, it will help you fall asleep, but it will actually disrupt your sleep cycles. And one thing that it will do, especially if it's a lot of alcohol or if you do it over time, is alcohol messes with blood sugars. And so it can cause this phenomenon where your blood sugar drops while you're asleep. And that alone will wake you up or will cause your brain to start going into scramble mode to make up for the extra sugar. Mm-hmm.
I saw a sign the other day about Red Bull Slurpees or something like that. And I, what about? I said, that's interesting. What about caffeine?
Yeah.
We hear that we shouldn't be doing it. Right. Is that true? I mean, it's a stimulant, so
right.
Does that affect sleep?
It does. And I have to be careful. I'm sensitive to caffeine, so I have to. My family knows that if they want to go shopping, they feed me some caffeine in the morning. I'm in a spending mood. But, you know, different people react to it in different ways. My wife is one of the people that can drink a cup of coffee and go right to sleep. You know, so there are people that it doesn't affect at all. But for those of us that it does, we need to really be careful. And I recommend definitely, again, it's kind of that 2 to 3 hour before bedtime mark. And really, my patients that have trouble with sleep, I tell them to avoid caffeine after noon if they can, anytime after noon.
It's a rather long-acting compound.
Yes.
So it can have long-term effects. If, mm-hmm. So that would be the reason for watching it after noon or something
right.
for people.
Right.
We talked about, or you had mentioned in some of the information we shared before, some the consequences of sleep debt. And let's talk about that briefly before we get into some specific sleep disorders. What do you mean by sleep debt, and what are the consequences of that that individuals may have long term, for example?
Right, yeah. So I see a lot of chronic sleep deprivation, and, you know, I do neurology as well as sleep. And a lot of my neurological patients will come in complaining of cognitive slowing. They just don't think as fast as they used to. Word finding is a big one. You know, it's right on the tip of my brain. I can't think of the word. You know, name recall, those type of things. Where did I put my keys? I see a lot of that with chronic sleep deprivation. Mm. In fact, that's one of the things that got me interested in sleep is in my second year of residency, I started having these memory issues. You know, it just wasn't as sharp as I used to be, having trouble with name recall and different things. And I was doing okay. I was just taking me a lot more time. And, you know, of course, when you're in that stage of your training, you're thinking of all these horrible things that it could be. And so worked me up and everything was normal. And then someone suggested doing a sleep study. And turns out I had sleep apnea, which surprised me because, mm-hmm. you know, usually we think of sleep apnea, or at the time anyway, we would think of someone relatively overweight. And, you know, I was average size at that time, so didn't have any real risk factors for it, but sure enough, I had it, and I got treated for it, and within 2 weeks, I was back to myself. It was amazing, so I'm a huge proponent of mm-hmm. treating sleep apnea or sleep disorders, mm-hmm. just because I've seen it work in my own life.
So I'm guessing a lot of people who come in with difficulty remembering or where they've lost things, especially as they age, is that they're having some kind of dementia starting, particularly Alzheimer's, but what you're saying is it doesn't have to be.
Doesn't have to be.
It can be very simply that we're not having enough sleep.
Exactly. Yeah, my brain's not getting the rest it needs. It's not getting the time to recharge itself. It's not able to rebuild those glycogen stores, so it can't fetch things as quickly as it should be. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I don't want to give anyone the wrong impression and, you know, think that that's, right. Oh, that's all that's wrong with me,
right.
But,
right.
you know, that very could well be. Could be. Yeah, and I see that a lot.
And as we age, sleep seems to change. I'm now 65, and I don't think I sleep exactly as long as I used to.
Right.
And so it can get real complicated with dementia mm-hmm. As you get older, less sleep,
yep.
and less sleep can cause similar symptoms. So
right. Yeah. Yeah. It's kind of a paradox.
It can but, get difficult.
And the thing that I have seen is even in my patients that have, and I'm talking the earlier onset dementia, you know, there comes a certain point where there's not much that helps. But even in my patients with the earlier stages of dementia, if we get their sleep cleaned up, their memory improves. So mm-hmm. even in that case, it can improve.
All right. What about other, are there other problems like diabetes or other problems that might be worsened or be actually even caused by sleep deprivation or a slow decrease in the amount of sleep you should be getting?
Yes, we know that people with untreated sleep apnea have higher risk of stroke, heart attack, diabetes, obesity, dementia. Seems like there's one or two other things that are slipping. I probably must not have slept well last night. But.
So how much sleep is needed? What I mean, you also see a lot of variability, and there's got to be a variability from person to person.
Yeah.
But what are the general rules that we know about?
Yeah, so the sort of rule of thumb is somewhere between, and this is a long range, but somewhere between 6 and 10,
mm-hmm.
you know, and we come up with the average of 8. And there are people that their body's just wired to where they don't need that much sleep. I've got one friend that, and he's almost got me convinced that all he needs is 4 hours of sleep. And I mean, that's, you know, he's done this his whole life. And then there are people that need 10 hours of sleep.
Mm-hmm.
But on average, most of us need between 7 and 9.
Mm-hmm. There seems to be some genetic component to sleep issues, and I mean, that shouldn't strike anybody very unusual, but I often find myself now, when I have sleep issues in children, getting to sleep, staying asleep, whatever, asking about other family members that have similar, and often mom and dad are very, very similar in those
yes.
things, so there are differences in us that are determined genetically, it appears.
Yes. Yeah, I see a lot of restless leg syndrome running in families, too, even in I've seen kids.
All right. And I think on a previous program we did, I'm going to ask this question, we'll go ahead and take our break, that if you get behind in your sleep, the comment by the person who was here and was that it's hard to catch up or you never catch up on that. And I meant to look that up, and if I did, I forgot. Do you find that an honest statement, or how would you respond to that?
Yeah, and I wouldn't say you never catch up, but I will say it takes a while for you to catch up.
Yeah, that makes more sense to me.
Yeah.
I mean,
otherwise, we're all in trouble.
We're pretty well-adapted organisms, and I would think that would be dastardly, and we should have been moved away by evolution over time somehow. All right, so it's not as easy to catch up from individual sleep deprivation as it might appear. By
if you
have a bad night, the next day you sleep an extra hour, it's not necessarily.
And if you're, you know, if you've gone weeks and weeks where you've only slept 4 or 5 hours a night, you're not going to get all that back in one or two nights of good rest. It's going to take a while.
Okay. All right. Well, let's we'll kind of dedicate the rest of the show to some very specific problems with sleep. And we have a call coming in. We have an email that I want to address. But let me remind everybody one more time. You're listening to Line 1, your health connection. Our local number is 550-8433. Our toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. And our email address is line1@alaskapublic.org. After this short break, we'll continue to our conversation about sleep and sleep disorders with Dr. Peter Osterbauer. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard.
You're listening to Line 1, your health connection from Alaska Public Media. The program repeats tonight at 9 p.m. on KSKA Anchorage and will not be taking phone calls. You can find Line 1, your health connection on iTunes or listen at alaskapublic.org.
Welcome back. I was just drifting off to sleep. you're listening to Line 1, your health connection on KSKA Anchorage. I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard, and I was not drifting off to sleep because this is a very interesting program, and our guest today is Dr. Peter Osterbauer. of the Alaska Neurology Center and the Alaska Sleep Disorder Center. And while I'm thinking about it, they asked me to mention to those people who are seeing them now or in the future that the whole organization, the Sleep Center and the Neurology Center, will be moving September 10th. They're going to be moving to the old Borders Book Building. That's at the Diamond and Old Seward. So if that helps you know where they're getting ready to go or you need to get to them in the future, that's the area they'll be after September 10th. So we're talking about sleep and sleep disorders, trying to address any questions that you have. You can reach us during the next roughly 25 minutes, 550-8433, and a toll-free number 1-888-353-5752. And our email address is line1@alaskapublic.org. And as a reminder, if you're listening on Monday between 9 and 10 on KSKA, you're listening to a recorded broadcast. We can't answer your questions. And if you want to listen to this program in the future or you want to refer someone to listen to it, just send them to alaskapublic.org. Tell them to find the Line 1 link, and you'll find our archives to this show and all of our previous shows. Before we answer some questions that are starting to come in, tell us about what happens with a sleep study. What do you guys do? What can they expect to happen at a sleep study?
They can expect to be hooked up to all kinds of stuff. So they come in, and I'll tell you, for our facility, it's different for each place. But what we do is have them come in about 7:30 or so, and hook them up to a bunch of wires and tubes. So basically, they'll have a few wires glued to their head, and that's to measure the brain waves so that we can see what stages of sleep they're going in and out of and anything else that might be going on in their brain. They will usually have a wire attached to one side of their face to see if they're grinding their teeth. They'll have a little tube under their nose to measure their breathing. They'll have wires attached to their chest to watch their heart rate. And they'll have one on each arm and each leg to see if they're moving in their sleep. They'll have a band around their chest and one around their belly to measure the rise and fall. An oxygen sensor on their finger. And I think that's it. There may be one or two other wires or tubes that I'm forgetting. And surprisingly, even with all that hooked up and attached to them, most of my folks are able to sleep with all that.
And it is important to get to sleep.
Yes.
Obviously.
Yes.
We haven't said that, but if you get tired enough, we're going to sleep.
Yep.
And most of the time we can then tell what's happening during sleep. And then there's a video monitor of sleep during that time, too. Is that generally true? So we can see what happens and how that correlates with the recordings that are done?
Exactly. You know, sometimes as we're reading the sleep studies, we might see something that looks kind of odd or or wondering, you know, what in the world happened with that. So we can look at the video and see if someone was up sleepwalking or, you know, up acting out a dream or something.
Okay. We have an email, and what I'd like to do is address that. And we have a couple of callers holding, and this is a question about Parkinson's and sleep. And it asks, it's very simply, please discuss any connection between Parkinson's and sleep and ways to get better night's sleep. Is sleep a particular issue with Parkinson's disease, I guess?
One thing that we do see in Parkinson's, and if someone has this, it doesn't mean you have Parkinson's. We just see it more often with that, is something called REM sleep behavior disorder. And what that is, we talked earlier about during REM sleep, our body paralyzes itself so that we don't move around while we're dreaming. Well, in REM sleep behavior disorder, and we're not exactly sure why, but for whatever reason, the brain doesn't paralyze the body. So the person will be acting out their dreams. So their bed partner will be bruised or, you know, a lot of times they'll have to sleep in another room because they'll be punching and kicking. And we see that with a fair, I'd say about 10% of my Parkinson folks have this REM sleep behavior disorder. And it's treatable with medication, but...
All right, so it's not specific for Parkinson's disease, but it is common in Parkinson's.
Yes.
Just like there's some disconnection between the ability to prevent that from happening as part of the disease process.
Right.
Okay. All right, let's move on. Jim, you're on line one. What can we do for you?
Yes, I had a question about the sleep you get before midnight versus the sleep after midnight, and I typically only get about 5 hours if I'm lucky, been that way for years.
Yeah, there's some controversy about that, and there was some thought, and I don't know where the most recent, where it's falling here recently, but there was some thought at one point that because of the magnetic pull of the moon, that the best sleep is between 10 p.m. and 2 a.m. Don't know how much truth there is to that. And as far as, so, you know, before, as far as before midnight versus after midnight, if that's something where you're in that camp, it sort of straddles that. The other thing that I think of is with shift workers that have to sleep during the day, and we can adapt to that somewhat, but we're really creatures made to sleep at night for whatever reason. I don't remember where I was going with that, but I had a good place. It'll come back to me.
That answer your question, Jim?
Yes, it does. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Are there hints for people? We had an email that's very similar to this. Hints for people who are doing shift work and moving on and off. Nurses are notoriously one group that I can think of that can make back and forth between different shifts.
Yeah.
And physicians.
Right,
for that
right.
Matter. ER physicians in particular. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It's important, if at all possible in your job, if you can get a shift that's relatively consistent, you know, that, growing up, I knew people that would work 2 weeks night shift, 2 weeks day shift, 2 weeks afternoons, and that can really mess with you. But if you are someone that can have a consistent, you know, if you have to work nights, if you can get that consistent, and the important thing is on your days off, make sure that you keep your consistent schedule as if you were working. So even if you have a day off, you want to sleep during the day to keep that pattern.
All right, Mike, you're on line one.
Well, you know, I've done a lot of research on this myself, and it surprised me. I know we don't know everything about sleep, but leg cramps in the night, it seems like nobody really knows for sure what causes them and what we can do about them. I mean, there's lots of different suggestions, but I've found that none of them really work.
Right.
Do you have any ideas on leg cramps?
Yeah.
What doesn't usually work.
Exactly.
It's easier for us to figure
that,
yeah.
And that can be a tough one, too, because it can be something as easy as an electrolyte imbalance. You know, potassium is one that gets a lot of press. It can be something as simple as that, or it can be as complicated as some type of a movement disorder, you know, which is fairly rare. But we do see that where people's legs tend to cramp up at night. I'm not sure if this is part of what where you're going with your question, but with restless legs syndrome, that can be a hard one because some people feel cramps, some people feel crawly feelings, some people feel pins and needles. It can be really hard to describe. But one of the most common treatable causes of that is iron deficiency. I see that quite a bit. And that can be a sneaky one because just a regular iron test won't show you what you need. You have to get a ferritin level, which is a storage form of iron. And most labs, the normal range for ferritin isn't normal as far as restless legs go. They'll have a normal range of, you know, 3 to 100 and something. But really, for people with restless legs, you need a ferritin of at least 55. So it can be kind of a tricky one if you don't know what to look for.
Is it ever a circulation problem? I find that one thing that helps is going for about a 30 or 40 minute walk each night before I go to bed.
Hmm. Yes, yeah, definitely. People with peripheral vascular disease are going to have we're going to be more prone to cramps and that type of thing.
But I'm a pediatrician, so I don't deal with this very much, but having talked to a number of times about peripheral vascular disease, I would think that one of the signs of peripheral vascular disease is you get worse and worse with exercise, so it would be more difficult for you if it was peripheral vascular disease. Does that make sense?
Well,
or am I
screwing
things
up? No, not at all. No, if you can get regular exercise, it'll help. It'll sort of force the blood to flow.
Okay. All right. Well, I know if I walk a long distance, I can guarantee you I will have some cramps at night. And I can remember having them even as a kid. I've been athletic my whole life. And nowadays I don't quite do as well. But if I walk 10 miles, which I did this weekend, I'm going to have muscle spasms at night. And actually fasciculations.
Right.
And things, so.
Yeah.
And
And one thing I find that exacerbates it is sugar. Hmm. Exercise with sugar, guaranteed cramps at night.
Huh. I don't know. I get that question a lot. And the old idea that it was, what was the stuff you always heard you give men who had muscle spasms, has now been shown.
Quinine?
Quinine, yeah. Absolutely doesn't work.
Yeah, and yep.
So, I mean, it may appear to at certain times, but the evidence is very good. It doesn't really help very much. So like, that's what I was thinking about when I said, well, it's easier for us to figure out what doesn't work.
Right.
It's easier to test that. All right. So we didn't help you, Mike.
Well, but you just keep searching when you don't have the answers.
Yep. Yep. When you find out, let us know.
Yeah.
Okay, I will.
Very, very common. But usually, many times, it's not a serious sign unless it's progressively getting worse is what I would tell you. Is that true?
Yeah, it's more of, usually it's more of an annoyance than anything.
Yeah. Okay. Thanks for your call. Brian, you're on line one.
Gentlemen, good talking to you. I picked up the radio and I heard you were talking about me, so I wanted to call. I've been diagnosed several times with apnea, and I put myself through a sleep study here, a second one, in hopes that I might be eligible for one of those mandibular devices, which unfortunately I wasn't, so they gave me a BiPAP machine. And consistently I've had difficulties adapting to these machines, you know, combination of dry mouth and everything else. And I've tried all the lotions and the suggestions from the distributors, but so far none of it works. And I think they're going to come steal my BiPAP machine from me for lack of use. But I went into the sleep study because I was noticing some mild cognitive issues. And in my research, that was one of the issues. And I just haven't been able to adapt to the equipment, and I was wondering if you had any suggestions.
Yeah, you know, most people, it does take a little getting used to. Like I said, I sleep with one myself, and it took me a little getting used to it first. And even now, once in a while, I'll wake up and realize that I've taken it off and thrown it across the room or something when I had a bad night. Mm. But yeah, I mean, it sounds like you've done the main things. You know, most of the all of the units that I prescribe, at least, and most of the units that are out today have a humidifier attached, which helps somewhat with the dry mouth and the dry throat. Even with that, it doesn't always completely solve the issue. But you know, there are, and again, I'm just saying this for anyone else that might be listening. It sounds like you've tried all this, unfortunately, but there are different types of masks that you can try and. The lotions to help keep from drying out. Unfortunately, it sounds like you've tried all the things that we would do. The mandibular device that you had talked about usually is for the sort of more mild to moderate cases of sleep apnea. That's what I started with mine, and it worked just fine, but I grind my teeth real bad, so I kept breaking them, so they made me get a CPAP, and the CPAP actually works better, at least in my experience, but the mandibular device is good because it's portable.
And that's an oral device, when
yes.
you say mandibular,
yeah.
So people understand. Yeah,
it's a dental appliance that you wear at night, sort of like a retainer in a way. It keeps your jaw forward to keep your airway open. If you're on BiPAP, it sounds like you probably have a more severe case of it. So there's CPAP, which stands for continuous positive airway pressure, where the machine will, we figure out what pressure you need, and the machine supplies that amount of pressure to keep your airway open at night, to keep you breathing. But once you go beyond a certain pressure, it gets really uncomfortable to breathe back out against that pressure. So we switch to what's called BiPAP, which has two pressures. It has a higher pressure for when you breathe in, and it keeps your airway open. And then it lowers the pressure so that you can breathe out, so it's easier to breathe out. And so usually people with the more severe sleep apnea require higher pressures, and the higher pressures, just for comfort reasons, we do a BiPAP.
Brian, hang on.
Well, I guess it's just stick with it and take my re-quip and
try. Yeah, hang on just a second. Let's talk about the consequences of sleep apnea. I mean, what I hear is that lots and lots of people are now being diagnosed with sleep apnea, and I hear of people who stop the equipment, both adolescents that I'm dealing with and parents who tell me about it. And so I think it's worth making sure we go over the long-term consequences of not addressing sleep apnea versus, hey, it's not a big deal, I'm going to stop this stuff.
Right, right, yeah. And, you know, we had mentioned briefly earlier, but people that have sleep apnea and that we don't treat it, I say we because I'm one of us, people that have sleep apnea, if we don't treat it, it puts us at about a 2 to 3 times greater risk for strokes and for heart attacks. It also puts us at higher risks for dementia and obesity and diabetes. And it just makes you feel not great during the day, just unrested and foggy. Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, Brian, what I was getting at is there's lots of people probably in a situation like you, and if we need better engineering, we need to find out that people are struggling with problems. So I'd encourage you to keep working with someone about solving your problem.
Yeah, the other thing, too, that I'll mention is that there are, and I don't know if you want to go this extreme or not, but there are surgical options,
right.
too.
I was going to mention that we haven't talked about sometimes surgical options can be of help.
Right.
Okay.
Well, they just jacked me up and gave me a new knee 2 weeks ago.
That's not one of the surgical answers, usually.
But if it works, let me know.
So far, it works pretty good.
All right.
Well, thank you very much for your help. I appreciate it.
I'm going to mention one more thing we haven't probably talked about, and that's weight, and losing weight can be very helpful, I think. I'm not a sleep specialist, and hopefully you're not terribly overweight, but that's one thing that could be effective for some people.
Yeah.
All right. All right. Thanks for your call.
Thank you very much.
So here's an email. It says, if an adult sleeps only about 2 hours at a time all night, every night. They ask, is there interference with REM time? I'm going to say, is there interference with REM time, or are there other consequences to that intermittent sleep?
Right, and there's a name for that, and I forget what that's called. I actually tried that myself in med school and failed horribly. When you're in med school, you grasp for whatever you think can work. But
what were you trying to do? You mean decrease REM sleep or maximize REM sleep?
and I think I may have it backward from their question. There was this pattern where you sleep for 20 minutes, and then you stay awake for 2 hours.
Yeah,
sleep,
okay.
You know, all throughout the day.
Yeah, yeah.
Didn't work for me.
Trying to beat Mother Nature.
Exactly.
Huh?
Yeah.
Not a good idea.
No. If
it's probably another weight loss idea.
When you start having hallucinations, that's when to stop.
Yeah. Okay. All right. So.
So sleeping 2 hours.
Consistently.
Generally, ballpark figure. A full sleep cycle, which would include REM, is 90 minutes. The only problem is we don't. Some of our sleep is not to the point that we're getting all of the different stages that we need each 90 minutes. So that would be the issue there.
Okay. All right. Here's another email. I'm going to choose this one because it does deal with pediatrics. And Dr. Ostenbauer does not deal specifically with pediatrics, but we're going to throw this one out here just to help you, I think. Says, I have an 8-year-old son with a trifecta of asthma, allergies, and skin issues, which is actually not an unusual trifecta. Mm-hmm. He's also had a hard time staying dry at night. We have finally helped him with a pee alarm, which is one of these things that either buzzes or vibrates or when you wet slightly to help train you not to do that. We have a family history of sleep apnea and large tonsils, as well as restless leg syndrome. He always seems to sleep longer than my other children, and I'm wondering if a sleep study would be a good advice for him. How do they work for younger children?
Yeah, and we had talked just a little bit about this before the show started today. It would be a good idea to get a sleep study for him. Both of my kids had sleep apnea. I'm trying to think. I think they were about 5 or 6 when we got their sleep studies. They had the big tonsils and everything. And, man, wake up the whole house with their snoring. For them, it was for kids, sleep apnea is usually just getting the tonsils removed. They usually don't have to use the CPAP machine or anything like that. But, boy, it makes a big difference.
All right. How much does a sleep study cost, and is it covered by insurance?
It is covered by insurance. I don't know what it costs, to be honest with you. I try to stay out of the money part of it so I can stay objective. But, yeah, it is covered by almost all insurance.
And so if you need to know the answer to that question, I suspect if you go to the Alaska Neurology Center, Alaska Sleep Disorder Center website, both of which are linked on our website, alaskapublic.org, you can get someone who can answer that specific question.
Yes.
I'm trying to go through some emails that are coming in, but before we do that, let's talk just briefly, or while I'm doing that, let me ask you to talk about insomnia, which is another, I think, pretty common question in pediatrics, and I'm sure in adults as well.
Right. And what I see, in my experience at least, most insomnia has to do with the sleep hygiene that we talked about earlier. People will get in a rut of, you know, one of the worst things that I see nowadays with teenagers with insomnia is they're texting while they're trying to sleep. You know, I've seen kids that their parents have got them on sleep medications, but really all they have to do is take away the cell phone. Hopefully there's no teenagers listening that are going to come hunt me down for saying that. But that and the video games right before bedtime, or I see a lot of times people with a TV in their bedroom, which is really a bad place for a TV, because I see people that will lay in bed and watch action shows. So they're stimulating their brain and they can't get to sleep. And falling asleep with the TV on is also not a great idea, because even though your eyes are closed, your brain can see the lights flickering through your eyelids, and that tends to stimulate the brain. So, you know, you may fall asleep, but the constant flickering is keeping the brain from getting in a steady state.
Mm-hmm. I saw, well, I'm wondering how much how often anxiety is a contributing factor to insomnia. I mean, so many of us have things that are bothering us, and when we go tonight, we begin to cogitate on that quite mm-hmm. a bit. And the reason I bring it up is I'm an avid podcast listener, not only because I'm interested in medicine and various aspects, but also I'm looking for people to talk to. And there have been several studies that shown if people will just take 5 or 10 minutes and write down on a piece of paper, and I know this, people are going to get weirded out by this, mm-hmm. what it is they're worrying about, that it was significantly helpful. And then I heard a podcast the other day talking about that writing really, your brain either works on an emotional or a logical level. It can't do both at the same time. And when you have an important decision to make, if you write down what it is that your decision, it takes that emotion out. You can't, if you're trying to think about it at the same time. So it finally made sense to me why writing things down before you go to sleep takes this emotional anxiety component out of sleep and can help people. And it's, apparently it's been pretty well studied. Mm-hmm. Have you heard that? Does that make sense to you?
Yeah, and I think that's a great idea. A lot of people will journal just before they go to bed. And, right. you know, that's I do see that a lot where people just have these racing thoughts when they lay down. And it's, you know, when we're during the day, we're go, 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 and our brain is busy focusing on other things. And then once things are quiet and slow, all those things that are bothering us and worrying us have time to creep to the surface and run around the wheel.
Yeah. It's common enough that I've almost jumped to the conclusion that a lot of people have trouble going to sleep. It has to do with anxiety. But there are other reasons. I mean, it seems to me, I run some family members that where I have a teenage girl and her dad has the same problem. They just cannot get sleep. And I said, no, I'm not racing. I'm doing everything right. They do their sleep hygiene right and everything.
Yeah, and I do see that. It's fortunately, it's the exception rather than the rule.
Okay.
But, man, those can be tough ones.
Yeah, because we all try to stay away from the medications because the medications can have their own consequences.
Right.
You want to talk about that briefly?
Yeah, one of the worst consequences is becoming dependent on them. Mm-hmm. You know, most of the, and I won't mention any specific meds, but most of the meds used for sleep are derivative of benzodiazepines, which is an anti-anxiety type medication, and those can be very habit forming. Mm-hmm. And so that's one of the major drawbacks. Right. Also, a couple of the meds will make people do weird things in their sleep, like drive to Walmart and bake cakes and you know, different things. And I've had a couple of people that couldn't figure out why they were gaining weight, but you know, every morning when they woke up, they had baked a cake, and you know,
wasn't that they forgot about it?
Exactly.
The medications can, I think, have also been associated with memory disorders and learning. At some, am I not remembering that correctly?
Yeah, I haven't heard that.
Okay, all right. Here's a question about Lexapro, which is being taken for anxiety, which is causing, or apparently the listener thinks, causes vivid dreams every night. Could this be preventing me from getting a good night's sleep? In other words, they're wondering if Lexapro is causing dreaming, particularly vivid dreams that are preventing sleep and maybe making things worse.
Right, and some of the meds in that particular class can cause some vivid dreams. Usually it's just right up front as you're starting the medication, and that will wear off after 2 to 4 weeks or so. If it continues to be a problem, you might want to talk to your doc about switching to a different med, but I do see that with some of the psychoactive meds.
We only have a couple more minutes, and I want to talk about briefly about restless leg syndrome. There's lots of other issues we could get into, but restless leg syndrome is a pretty common thing. This is a treatable problem, and so let's talk about it.
Yeah, and that it can really disrupt your sleep. I mean, these are the people that, you know, like I said earlier, it can be anything from a crawling feeling to an itching. It really depends on the person, the way they describe it. But if you move your legs or your feet around temporarily, it will relieve the symptoms, but as soon as you stop moving, the symptoms come back. It's not that your legs are involuntarily moving all over the place. It's that if you move them on your own, the symptoms will stop. But then as soon as you stop moving, the symptoms come back with a vengeance. And, you know, I get people that have to pace the floors at night, and I mean, that can really disrupt your sleep.
And you don't have to be asleep to have the problem.
No. I think there's a misconception or a confusion between restless leg syndrome and periodic limb movements of sleep, which restless legs is the one that you're awake and you feel happening, whereas the periodic limb movements are where your legs are twitching while you're asleep.
Those are different problems.
Different problems.
We didn't mention, again, we've got about a minute, what are the symptoms that someone might know that their sleep partner has sleep apnea?
That they can't sleep themselves because of the snoring.
Does the person stop breathing for a period of time?
Yep, a lot of times they'll see them stop breathing. They might not always notice it because some of it's subtle, but they can stop breathing. They'll hear them choking in their sleep or gasping for air. Or if they, you know, even if they sleep in another room, they might just notice that during the day they're sort of mentally foggy and tired all the time.
Last 40 seconds or so, suggestions, things you want to leave people making sure they've heard today?
Yeah, the main thing is just remember that sleep is important. You can't get enough, but you can.
Yeah. Sleep deprivation does have some consequences.
It does. It just, you know, overall quality of life.
All right. Well, thanks very much for taking the time to be with us. Very much appreciate our guest, Dr. Peter Ostabar, being with us, and I hope everyone learned something from us today. And if you'd like to continue this conversation, you can join us on KSK on Facebook, where you can find that link at alaskapublic.org. And you'll also find, as we mentioned previously, the Line 1 archives. If you'd like to just share your thoughts and suggestions about the program, you can go to line1@alaskapublic.org. You know, the study of happiness is growing as a field of interest as we learn more about how the brain works and produces feelings of well-being. And on the next Line 1, Prentice Pemberton is going to return to host and discuss the science and psychology of happiness with Anchorage psychologist Jennifer Baith. So why not tune into Health and learn more next Monday, July 29th at 2 p.m. Pat Yak is Chief Contact Officer at Alaska Public Media. Kristen Spack is our web editor and helped us with the engineering today. Thanks for listening. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard. Have a great day.
Line 1 is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the host and participants and do not reflect the underwriters or KSKA. Learn more about Line 1 and listen online at alaskapublic.org. Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.